Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 18th of January. I'm so happy we have Calvin Trillin with us this hour. And he's written this book about his wife, Alice. It's just so lovely. I mean, it's not flowery, and it's nothing less than very honest, and how blessed they were to have each other for a longer period of time than they thought they might have some years ago. The book is about Alice. Alice died 5 years ago, and the book is about their family, and it's about her decency as a human being and her very central role in Calvin's life. He is author, well, he's written a number of books, but let me just say, because we want to get right into Alice, that he's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1963. He lives in New York. He has two daughters, and they figure prominently in this book, and grandchildren as well, and the book is dedicated to them. So that's all I want to say about Calvin. Last time he was on, we gave him a long introduction, but this time, this is about Alice. And so we thank you, Calvin Trillin, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I love this book. And you know this, and we're going to try and play this. We tried to play it at the beginning of the show, but I was going downstairs to get a cup of coffee yesterday as I was reading your book at my desk. And the piano music that was coming across in the lobby was that song, "It's Very Clear Our Love Is Here to Stay." And I thought,
oh, yeah.
Isn't this perfect? I'm reading his book, and here's this song. I've always loved that song, and they seem to go together.
Yeah, I like that song, too.
Yeah, it's nice. So a lot of the letters that you received made you cry, but one made you laugh. And let's start with that one of, you know, you're a wonderful guy, but how did you nail Alice?
Yeah, that was it was from Roger Wilkins, who I used to eat lunch with now and then, with also a New Yorker reporter named Richard Harris, who was an investigative reporter of sort of aggressively cynical worldview, as often happens with people in that line of work. And Roger wrote a letter saying, "Well, I thought you were a wonderful guy, but I always wondered how you managed to get Alice." And and I asked Harris once, and he said it was just dumb luck. I think that's probably about right.
Yeah. I always love to hear first meeting stories. Why don't you tell us about the first meeting stories, because it's a good one.
Well, this was at a magazine called Monocle, which was a magazine of political satire. I should say a doomed magazine of political satire. It was a magazine that whose party seemed to get larger and larger as its financial position became more precarious. And a number of people met either through Monocle or around the time they were connected with Monocle. I always told the editor that Monocle was more successful as a marriage brokerage than as a magazine. And we called them Monocle marriages, and they were all long-lasting. Mm. There were no divorces. And somebody asked me the other day how I accounted for that, and I said the only way I can account for it, I had never thought of that before, but that maybe this magazine, which thought of itself as such a hip, cutting-edge magazine of political satire, had attracted the squarest people in New York. and because we got married and stayed married in a period where I wrote once that long-term marriage became intertwined in the public mind with the music of Lawrence Welk. I mean, it was a very, very square thing to be.
Yeah, right.
And I saw Alice at that party, and I was instantly taken by her, and I didn't get to talk to her much at that party for one reason or another, but I managed to get to a party about 10 days later where I had reason to believe she might be. And I talked to her a lot at that party, and I compared it in the book to a lounge comic who hears that a booker for the Tonight Show is in the audience.
Hmm.
And years later, 20 or 30 years later, she would say, "You've never been funnier than you were that night." And I always said, "You mean I peaked in December of 1963? She'd say, I'm afraid so.
Maybe not, Kellen. Maybe not. Let's talk about your children for a while. I love the passages about your children. You say, when you're asked about how both of your daughters came to be involved in the sort of work they do, Abigail, a legal services attorney for children, Sarah, a clinical social worker, you naturally deny having anything to do with it is probably not true. But that she instilled certain values in them, and she did it well, and you did as well, because look at what they're doing in the world.
Well, I hope we had something to do with it. After Alice died, one of her friends wrote that she managed to navigate those tricky waters between living a life you can be proud of and taking great pleasure in what there was to take great pleasure in
yes,
life.
Yes, I like that.
And I hope the girls were watching that, and I think they were.
Mm-hmm.
I myself, when my older daughter said she thought she might want to be a legal services lawyer, when she came down for breakfast in the morning, would tell her the temperature and the starting salary for associates at Cravath, Swain & Moore.
Yeah, come on.
hoping that might turn her into avarice, or at least a kind of healthy respect for the buck.
And it didn't happen, right? She also, I love this, she not only had to go to the opening night or the closing night of the girls' performances and plays, she had to be there every night.
Yeah, I wrote once that, and it's one of the epigraphs in front of one of the chapters in this book, that that Alice's rule on school plays, by which she included pageants and recitals and gymnastic demonstrations and anything else, was that if you didn't go to every performance, including the special Thursday matinee for the fourth grade, the county would come and take the child. She considered that child abandonment, pretty much. And I later decided, as I wrote here, that she was right about school plays. If you have the luxury, which some people don't, I mean, people who have to show up at an office or do shift work and can't go to any performances don't have that luxury. But for parents who do, it seems to me that school plays were put on earth partly to give parents an easy way to demonstrate their priorities.
Yes. And as you write, it was true for her and true for you that your children were at the center of your lives, which is as it should be. They were central.
Well, I thought, I wrote that in the context of talking about what I guess all young parents talk about sometimes is like child-rearing policies. You know, you children of toddlers always know somebody who is absolutely certain that if you do it one way, your child is going to grow up to be perfect, and if you do it another way, you have injured the child in a devastating way. And of course, they're opposite things, and about either strict or not strict, or what food or not food, or whatever these things
mm-hmm.
are. And I think that we agreed that your children are either the center of your life or they're not, and the rest is commentary.
Yes.
It doesn't really make a whole lot of difference. First place, you can't really adopt a policy if it's contrary to the way you are. The children could see through that in 10 seconds. So you don't really have any choice in the matter, and all you can do is make sure that you keep your eye on that fact.
Mm-hmm. What was it like, and you must miss this a great deal, well, you miss everything about such a wonderful person, but this, she read everything that you wrote in rough draft. That's a crucial kind of partnership, isn't it? And you listened to what she said, you listened to her laugh, you listened to her not laugh.
Yeah, I think that was partly because I really wanted to know what she thought. I valued her opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I said in the book, it's not as if I had married a biologist or a financial analyst or something like that. It was her field. I mean, she had a master's degree in English, and she had worked at a publisher for a year. In fact, she worked at Random House for a year. And she had designed courses in the writing process and made movies about it and things. So I said it was like having a high-powered lawyer in the house, and you're his only pro bono case. And she was often asked to read things by other people, including a friend of ours who had written a 1,600-page novel. She suggested some cuts in that one.
Good advice.
But then aside from that, I think I wanted to impress her. I wanted her to like what I wrote. Yes, if I heard her laugh from the other room, it was a great triumph, unless, of course, the piece wasn't meant to be funny.
Yes. And so you wanted to impress her after all those years, right? You wanted to put forth your best for her. I just think that's wonderful.
Yeah, I did. I'm not sure I ever verbalized that in my mind, you know, even in my mind. But when I started writing about it, I realized that that's what I had done all those years.
Yeah. Tell me about you. There were things that she liked and there were things that she didn't like. I like this quality about her of being very direct. Tell the story of when you were one of the keynote speakers along with Governor Pataki at an event. It was funny.
This was at a Yale event, the Yale Westchester scholarship dinner, where they raise money for Westchester scholarships for boys from Westchester and now girls as well, or now men and women, I guess we call them, going to Yale. And I was one of the speakers, and so was Governor Pataki. And Westchester, as you may know, is sort of thought of, that's where Alice grew up. It's sort of thought of as a as the prosperous suburbs of New York, but it also has some areas that are quite poor. And Governor Pataki actually grew up in very modest circumstances in the northwest part of Westchester County. And he didn't have a reputation in New York as being a very eloquent speaker, but he gave a wonderful talk about, short but really quite moving talk about, I guess it was his brother who got into Yale first but wasn't given a scholarship. And years later, after his father died, Governor Pataki found out that his father, who worked at the post office, after work one day drove to New Haven and asked to see the director of admissions, who he naturally was told was busy, but he waited until he wasn't busy. And he said, I'm a postal worker, and how do you expect my son to go? You're supposed to be smart. You're college people, and you've let him in. How do you expect him to go without a scholarship? And, of course, the director of admissions picked up the phone and called the Westchester Yale alumni. But it was quite a beautiful speech. And when he sat down, Alice said, that was a great speech. Why in the world are you a Republican? She was very direct, and she had what I call a sort of instinct for the avoided subject. I always told her that if we had had the misfortune of living in the milieu when I was a executive trying to rise in the corporation,
she wouldn't have made it.
She was supposed to be the supportive corporate wife. I would have been mired in middle management for the entire time.
And your life would have been so dull, right, Calvin?
Yes,
so
right.
Dull. Who reads for you now when you have that rough draft? Do you have anybody to give it to or not?
No.
No.
I never did except for her. I showed this to my girls, but more to make sure that there wasn't anything in it that they thought was embarrassing or you know they didn't want to see in print. Rather than reaction. Alice wasn't exactly an editor of the pieces, but she was a first reader, which is important just to get responses of how it works or whether it doesn't work.
I can't imagine that the girls or anybody would think there's anything embarrassing in this book, Calvin.
Well, they didn't have any problems with the book, and I mean, I always have said that I have a terrible disadvantage in writing memoirs, but particularly childhood memoirs, in that the memoir business in America now is sort of an atrocity arms race. You know, if someone mm-hmm. talks about incest, the next person has to have bestiality or something like that. And so I thought of myself as under some disadvantage of having I wouldn't say this if it weren't a Midwestern radio station, had a happy childhood. I wouldn't admit that in New York.
Let's welcome some phone calls. Calvin Turlin is our guest. The book has just come out. I hope that some of you have had a chance to read it. It actually was published in a shorter form in The New Yorker last spring, I believe, and became one of those articles that everybody said, have you read the piece by Calvin Turlin? You've got to read it. You've got to read it. And it became then a longer book. And I think some of the ultimate compliments about this book are from young people who are about to get married and are expressing the hope that their fiancés can love them as much as Calvin loved Alice. But it's not mushy at all. It's just, you know, it captures who she was and their family. And we'll talk about the extra 25 years that she was given. She was diagnosed with lung cancer at a very young age and never smoked. And at one point, it's like a flower pot, he talks about, falling on her head, out of nowhere. How do you deal with that? And that's an important part of this book as well. So we'll move into that in a moment. Did I give you the number? It's 800-486-8655. I don't know if this is the kind of conversation you can join in on. I could listen to Calvin talk all hour about this. If you want to, feel free. The phones are open for you. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Calvin Turlin is our guest, and we're talking about his book about Alice, which has just been published by Random House. Let's talk about this diagnosis. She was so young. The last lines of the book are such knockout lines that she was given 25 years of life. I'm so lucky, and she felt that and said that she was so lucky, and then you say, I try to think of it in those terms too. Some days you can and some days you can't, and I understand that. But she was diagnosed with this horrible disease, and she was so young, and she didn't even smoke.
Yeah, it seemed like some awful mistake.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a mistake, and our girls were then 4 and 7.
Ooh, my.
And Alice was 38, and she had literally never smoked a cigarette. Her parents were both heavy smokers. Her mother was a chain smoker, and her father always had a cigar in his mouth. So she grew up in this haze, but she didn't claim to know that that's what caused it. She only thought that if we had, if they had known what we know now, they wouldn't have smoked in front of her.
Mm-hmm.
She became sort of a zealot on the subject of cigarettes. Just came out of nowhere. I think Alice approached it the way she approached everything. She was sort of an activist and she wanted to know as much about it as possible, and she wanted to be at a place where people knew the most about it. And she also wrote about it, and she wrote not sort of about her treatment or anything like that, but about the sort of existential question of the talisman you use in those situations to try to stave off death. And she talked about some people do religion, some people think they could do it by will, and I guess I was did the will part. I mean, I just thought that we weren't going to allow it to happen.
Mm-hmm. And she was really at first a 10% survival chance, but she made it 25 more years.
Yes, and we had one or two scares in those times, one fairly quickly, and then one in 1990, in which everybody at Memorial Sloan Kettering seemed to think that she'd had a recurrence. And what was amazing to me is that without any more evidence coming in, I mean, working on the same tests and the same x-rays, et cetera, that gradually the opinion changed to the belief that it wasn't a recurrence. And that turned out to be true.
And then it was eventually the treatment that gave her 25 years, but the treatment she died from.
The sort of carpet bombing radiation, which she had in 1976. Radiation has a kind of like a half-life. It keeps going. And her heart was, and arteries were damaged seriously by that.
And she had to have emergency open heart surgery. I mean,
yes,
right away.
She did. She had. She. I mean, this was picked up in a routine physical, and then she went to get a angiogram, and then she had surgery that day. And she never quite completely recovered from the surgery.
And there were all these big things going on. One daughter had been married some months before. Another daughter was about to be married.
Yeah, she got out of the hospital, and I think about 5 or 6 hours before the second wedding, which was our older daughter, and which was in New York. And she was there. She gave a toast and everything. Walked down the aisle.
And what about this idea? What I'm not sure what makes some days think she was given, for you to think she was given 25 years, and in other days for you to think that that you were lucky, and other days you're thinking, I'm not lucky. It should have been, you know, even 25 more years. What triggers that in you, Calvin?
Oh, I don't think anything special. I mean, I think anybody who's lost a spouse would probably tell you that these things are not predictable.
Right.
And people, you know, find themselves bursting into tears at the supermarket, you know, for no particular reason, and talking about what seem to be disturbing things fairly easily. So I don't think they are predictable. I think that just comes upon you.
Yeah. Are your daughters near now, or do they live far away?
I have one daughter who's only about an hour away, and one daughter in San Francisco. But I see her a lot. Mainly I see my grandchildren a lot.
Right.
I now refer to my daughter and son-in-law as the adult attendants, I see them about once a month.
Good for you. Yeah. Let's welcome some phone calls. Julie from Wausau. Hi, Julie.
Hi, good morning. It's so nice to listen to somebody speak so wonderfully about somebody they married and obviously loved so much. And I sympathize with you in one way. My mother is in the hospital right now with lung cancer and is in pretty rough shape. So I can sympathize with that end of it. But my question actually is, you obviously had quite a relationship with your wife, and I feel like I do with my husband, and I have four children who are also the center of our lives. And sometimes our marriage gets lost in that shuffle where we just don't seem to find as much time for each other as we'd like to. And I just wondered if you and your wife ever did anything together that was really special.
Yeah, I think we were conscious of getting away by ourselves. My wife was, when the girls were growing up, had real difficulty not being, being away from them. And we, at one point, I mentioned it in the book, we went to Asia I was doing a couple of stories in Asia.
And, that memorable trip to Japan, yeah.
Yeah, it was a couple of weeks, and after that she decided that 1 week was about the limit. But you can do a lot in a week. You can go to the Caribbean or something in a week. We used to say that to the girls that they were they could go to Europe when they were old enough to eat mushrooms. And we used to take them to England to stay with friends every couple of summers. But we finally did start taking them to Europe. We would rent a place rather than go from hotel to hotel, and it was just not. I've seen kids in Europe in these sort of torture situations where they thinking they can't face one more cathedral. We didn't do it that way, but often the trips to someplace like Europe or the Caribbean or something were just the two of us.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Julie?
Well, I just, it's so nice to hear somebody talk so lovingly about a spouse, because everybody around us is divorcing, and it's just so lovely to hear somebody that had such a wonderful marriage and focused on their children, and that's what my husband and I believe, too, and it's just very refreshing, and I appreciate your book and appreciate you speaking with everybody about that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. And you're getting that kind of response to this book from... I mean, it's such a love story. I'm so glad you wrote it. Aren't you glad you wrote it, just in terms of what you're bringing forward in your readers?
Yeah, and as I said, some of that was sort of surprising to me. Because I didn't know that I was writing about love or marriage or anything like that. I just thought I was writing about Alice. And
you were doing all of that.
So, I was somewhat surprised.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Alice's beauty. There's a picture of the two of you on the back of the book, and she really was knockout beautiful, just a beautiful, beautiful person. You talk about at parties she often attracted what you called guys smoking pipes.
Yeah, I always called them guys smoking pipes who wanted to impress her with their suavity or their intellectual depth. And I didn't blame them. I mean, I'm hardly anybody to criticize somebody for trying to impress her. And I would say, mention a guy smoking a pipe on the way home, and she would say, knowing who the guy what I was talking to about was, you know, he wasn't actually smoking a pipe. And come to think of it, none of those guys smoking pipes smoke pipes. But I thought of him that way. And I guess I didn't realize until I was married to Alice that being beautiful is sort of complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean it's complicated because you're taken for somebody you're not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's resentment, it's not the sort of problem I ever had to face. So, it is complex. I remember sitting across at a dinner, a kind of charity thing, from a woman who was a hugely rich sort of social person. And she looked across the table at Alice and said, your wife is so beautiful. And I said, thank you. And she said, do you have her painted often?
Oh, my.
And that was so far out of the context of our lives.
Right.
All I could picture was a guy we called Joe the Painter who came and painted the house when we... And I could see him kind of standing in front of Alice with one of these roller things with a long thing. And then I realized she was talking about portraits.
Oh, Calvin. Yeah.
And so I mean, on the other hand, you know, she never got tickets. I mean, there were a lot of advantages to being pretty.
She didn't get tickets when she was 50, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know, I don't detect, though, any, and I, you know, it's a human emotion, but... You don't strike me as this kind of guy either. A lot of husbands would be, you know, just a tad bit jealous of those guys smoking pipes. But I don't get a trace of that in your book.
Well, you know, I think that since she wasn't exactly who she looked like, I mean, she wouldn't have necessarily been impressed by that, you know. About,
mm-hmm.
So I didn't have those feelings.
Mm-hmm. You both had Jewish mothers.
Yeah, I had a Jewish father as well, but she had a Baptist Southern father, and I always claimed that at that first Monocle party, I said to the editor, who's that cute little Jewish girl over by the punch bowl? And Alice always said that story wasn't true, and furthermore, there wasn't any punch bowl. But it helped. It helped. My mother was, particularly when I reminded her that Jews believe in matrilineal descent, that, mm-hmm. That is, if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish. And a couple of weeks after she met Alice, she called me from Kansas City and said, you know, I was talking to Rabbi Hadas about that matrilineal descent thing. And I said, you mean you happened to run into Rabbi Hadas while strolling on the plaza and you fell into another one of your Talmudic discussions and matrilineal descent came up? And she said, well, whatever. He says you're right. And I said, well, thank you very much.
Oh, Mom. That's funny. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 if you'd like to join us. Calvin Trulin is our guest, and he's written about his wife, Alice. That's one of my favorite names, too. Alice and Margaret. I love both those names. About Alice is the book. It has just been published by Random House. Calvin Trulin, of course, a staff writer for The New Yorker for a number of years and author of all kinds of books. He says he wrote everything for Alice, and this one is for Alice. So if you'd like to join us, feel free. If not, we'll just keep talking about Alice. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Oh, the Milwaukee number is 227-2050. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Calvin Trulin is our guest, and we're talking about Alice, his wife, who died 5 years ago. The book is about Alice. It has just been published by Random House and is well worth a read. It's just it's a real lovely book. The other part of this, and you mentioned parents here, Alice always, I guess how we take care of our parents is a measure of who we are as well, and her parents were had somewhat complicated lives in a way, and she, as what you say, she was almost their only living relative. She saved them. She saved them on occasion, right?
Yeah, I mentioned in the book that when, I guess we were in our 30s, it occurred to me that we could divide people we knew of our contemporaries by people who were still dependent on their parents in either financially or emotionally or something, in some way psychologically. And people who were no longer dependent on their parents or, in fact, whose parents were dependent on them.
Mm-hmm.
And Alice was the caregiver very early. And even when I first met her, she was teaching at Hofstra. She was taking loans out to help her father. She wrote about all this, or I wouldn't have written about it.
Mm-hmm.
But she wrote a piece about her parents. Her father was an inventor and struck it rich at one point, right around the time Alice was born, in the late 30s, with a, or maybe that's when he went broke, around the time Alice was born, but he invented some early coin changers for vending machines, and then, like a lot of inventors, was a lot better inventor than a businessman, but mm-hmm. thought he should be a businessman. And they had a big house with a bowling alley in the basement and a swimming pool. And then after that, for a long time, he essentially never hit the jackpot again. And he, I think, as I can piece it together, lived on sort of R&D always had. He was a very sunny, optimistic man. So that, this was, and there were some illnesses, and essentially her parents sort of disintegrated over the years, but starting pretty early. So she was the person who was responsible, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she went, where did she go to school? Did she go to Wellesley?
She went to Wellesley.
Yeah.
Her father really sort of bought into the American dream tycoon system and couldn't acknowledge that excuse me, that his daughter would need a scholarship to Wellesley. So he arranged to pay by the month or something like that.
Right.
And that's sort of why we got married in England, because Alice thought they would feel they needed to do the wedding, and they really weren't up to it even then. So we were going to go to England anyway, so we just got married there.
Yeah. The letter, I mean, she wrote a lot of letters, but I like this values letter that you have in the book, a letter she wrote to the girls, that they should worry about being kind and generous to other people, to be honest with yourself and with others, to find meaning in the work that you do, and not to overvalue financial success. Pretty good values, huh?
Yeah, and those were certainly her values.
Yeah.
She thought that. I think we probably disagreed on the extent to which parents are responsible for how their children come out. You know, I mean, there obviously is an argument for luck of the draw, and I don't mean that it was 100% that either one of us thought, but I would have put probably a little more emphasis on luck of the draw than she would.
Mm-hmm.
But she thought particularly that that was true in the matter of values.
Mm-hmm.
What she called the big things, and she thought we did that. If you looked hard at the way we raised the girls, that you could discern some sort of policy, which is to not get excited about the little things, but be very strict about the big things.
Right.
And the big things, I think, to her were values.
Yeah, and speaking as the mom of a almost 15-year-old. When do you really notice that, Kelvin? Are they in their 20s? Or because the teen years, and you write about this in the book, too, particularly with Sarah, it's not all easy going all the time.
No. Sarah and Alice they never yelled at each other, but they would have these conversations that I always thought, if I happened to be within earshot, that they always said one too many sentences. You know? They say, "Oh, this is a good time to end this one right here."
That's a good idea.
But they never quite did.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any really horrible teenagers. I read somewhere once that by actual statistic, most teenagers don't act as much like teenagers. Don't really act have the sort of most overt teenage behavior pattern. What we associate with that. I remember when Abigail, my older daughter, who very good-natured, came down for breakfast when she was 13, I said, "Well, you're a teenager now. You want to throw a snit or something?" And she said, "No, I'm kind of tired and I'm late for school. I think I'll skip it." So I don't know. We had some of that, but not very much.
I guess a good dose of humor helps with all of this, doesn't it, Kelvin?
Well, I think so. I mean, mm-hmm. I think... but fortunately, both of the girls were tuned into that, and Sarah particularly could always make me laugh.
Yeah, and you could make a lot of people laugh. So, what do you deal with this? You know, I have a real hard time with people dying. The older I get, the bigger problem I have with this. Anyhow, I don't know where we go. I don't know what it means. I get in this existential angst about the whole thing. What's the value of the individual life, et cetera. How did you deal with that? And how do you deal with that 5 years after she's gone? she lives on, obviously, and you've done this incredible tribute to her that's going to be so important to so many people to read, but what do you do with the fact that she's not there anymore? Do we live on, do people just live on in memory eventually? How do you make sense of all of it?
Well, I don't. I remember when I had a heart bypass operation, and beforehand we read a little bit about it and heard about people going into deep depressions after a successful heart bypass operation. And one of the theories is that they had all of these thoughts about mortality, et cetera, and it got terribly depressed. Mm. And I said to Alice, I think my essential superficiality is going to hold me in good stead in this situation. I'm going to think, hey, glad we're out of that one.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, it's just I've just never been. I guess I've always felt about death. I mean, I find the Navajos of feeling about death very appealing, which is basically they don't even want to think about.
Hmm.
So I don't think it's one of my strong suits of any sort of mm-hmm. philosophical thinking about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. What about what Alice taught you about how to die?
Well, you know, we didn't think she was going to die. It's not as if she sort of faded away. She was hopeful, and I was hopeful till the end.
And mm-hmm.
I mean, we knew she was pretty sick. She was waiting to see if she qualified for a heart transplant. But one of her doctors, in fact, had a heart transplant. You know, we didn't think of that at the end of the road. And so it wasn't one of those cases in which somebody knew she was going to die and then sort of prepared everybody for it.
Mm-hmm. Except that this the sort of charging ahead that she had, you write about her being wheeled away as she was about to have that emergency heart operation. And
yeah, well,
the response is, I'm going to get a new heart. I'm going to get a
yeah.
new heart.
She was as what she called an incorrigible and ridiculous optimist.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's the way she did look on that heart operation, that we were just going to take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no idea that her heart had been damaged that way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the universe of people who have lived for 25 years after surgery for lung cancer is rather small.
Mm-hmm.
Since only 10% of the people survive lung cancer, and most people who get lung cancer are quite a bit older than that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there had been a lot of experience with people in Alice's condition.
Mm-hmm. Was this book hard to write, Calvin?
Well, it was emotionally hard to write, but it wasn't. I don't know if the word is technical. It wasn't technically hard to write. I think that it sort of opened up to me how it was going to be written as I went. And some pieces do that, and some don't. And I think of it as sort of walking in the woods. And sometimes, if you're trying to make a trail through the woods, sometimes things just kind of open up naturally, and sometimes you never get through the thickets. And this one was not difficult structurally, or at least maybe I pressed some of those feelings about how difficult it was, but it was difficult emotionally. Yeah, I would sometimes stop mm-hmm. doing it for a while.
I'm sure. And was it, did you get so much response to the shorter version that was in the New Yorker that you were urged to make this a book, or how did that happen?
That's exactly how it happened. Or I don't know whether it was the response that made the publishers eager to do it as a book, but I at first wasn't eager to do it because I said I didn't want to pad it out. I didn't want to mm. add a lot that wasn't supposed to be in there. And also, the response to it made me think that I didn't quite understand what was in there, and so I didn't want to tinker with it very much.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they didn't care how long it was. Mm-hmm. So I actually added quite a few words and then took an awful lot of them back out again. So it's only about maybe 15% longer than the piece in the New Yorker, mm-hmm. and it's in the same categories, and you know, I didn't add it, you know, separate chapters.
Mm-hmm. So at some point, maybe this is just me wanting to know, but will you write about the 5 years since she died at some point?
I don't think so.
Really?
yeah, I'm not sure how interesting it would be to start with, but I think it would be more of a sort of a reflective piece, and I'm not very good at that.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, just in the last few minutes, tell me about your grandchildren. You know, I would imagine that you have maybe silent conversations with Alice about them. You see them often, and this was the part of her life that she missed.
Yeah, she knew that my older daughter was pregnant, but she never saw the baby. And, yeah, it's obviously sort of mixed feelings when I'm with them because of that. But they're, being a grandfather is obviously a great joy. And I see, as I say, the ones in San Francisco fairly often, and they're here for Christmas, and they're here, and they're in Nova Scotia for summer, a couple of weeks, and I'm in San Francisco a lot. And the ones in near New York, that daughter just had, at the end of August, another baby, so I go down on Mondays when her husband has a long day, and sort of be with her and the two kids. And I did it before when my older grandson Toby was born on Tuesdays. We used to call it Tuesdays with Toby. And, so I see a lot of them, and somebody told me that being a grandparent is one of the few things in life that's everything it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I think that's pretty much true.
Is it? Yeah, I've heard that. One more short phone call. Pat from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that when your piece came out in the New Yorker, the contrast between all of the press about Joan Didion's memoir and then the piece about Alice was just so dramatic to me. That's just a comment. But then my question is, did Alice like Kansas City? I'm from Kansas City, and I know you are too, and I'm just curious.
Well, I wrote once that kept offering to take her back to Kansas City and buy her a house overlooking the brown waters of Lake Lackawanna. And the fact that she never answered me made me think that she probably wasn't enthusiastic about that move. She became a lot happier about Kansas City when I discovered a clothing place called Asiatica of people who were had almost kind of all the dissertation history of art degrees who made clothing out of antique kimono cloth. And so she got a lot cheerier about going to Kansas City after we found them. And then people, if we were at some place like the New York Public Library where there were a lot of people with fancy clothes on, they would say to Alice, "My God, where'd you get that?" that shirt, and I would always step in and say, "Kansas City, of course. I mean, where else would find that sort of eye? That's Kansas
course.
City."
Oh, thanks, Pat, so much for being with us. Kelvin, thank you. I'm so happy you wrote this book, and I know so many people will feel that way as well. It's just thanks for writing it, okay?
Well, thank you for saying so.
Yeah. Kelvin Trillin, our guest, the book is about Alice. It is about his wife, Alice, and it's just been published by Random House, and a lot of people are reading it because of the way he writes and because of who they were together and because of his strong marriage and just honest portrayal of their life. He was blessed. Well, Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks everybody for listening. This show will repeat tonight at 10 o'clock if you want to tell anybody about this wonderful love story, or you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's